Hello, welcome everybody. Today we have an awesome guest. His name's Kistan Patil. I think he corrects me later on in the show, but it's we have a Patil, and he's awesome. We talk about pretty much his life story, his up and coming as an entrepreneur, and yeah, it was fun. I couldn't find a good point to add in like a break and cut out our earlier conversation. So if it sounds a little choppy for the first half, it's just mainly me trying to figure out, do I cut here? Do I cut there? And I just decide halfway through I'm leaving it, and I'm just going to say it up front so you're not confused. All right. This is going to be awesome. We go into some really good stuff. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Josh Bolton Show, where we dive into interesting and inspiring conversations. And now, your host, Josh Bolton.
Hello, how are you doing?
I apologize, Josh. I didn't mean to run late on you here.
I was just sitting here like, did I forget to send a notification or something?
I was on helping a sales rep out, and it was awesome that the other person, because I had the screen share, so I didn't even see the time or anything. she's like, hey, I had to run to meeting. I was like, oh shit, I do too. And it worked out really well. And then I looked at the calendar link and wasn't on there, so I had to go dig in chat and find it. So, but yeah, no, we're on track. I thank you for the patience.
Oh, it's all good. I was just sitting there like, what? Did I do something wrong?
well, that's nice of you. I would have jumped to, what are they doing?
So how long do I got you for? It sounds like you got back-to-back meetings.
Yeah, but I think I got a break. Oh yeah. You got me. I had like a full hour after this. So you got all the time you need.
Cool. Cool. Then, just to make sure, it's Kistan Patil.
Kisan. It sounds Kisan. Like Nissan with a K.
Kisan Patil. Okay, cool. Now I'll put a break in real quick, cut all that out. And then, just real quick, we're going to go, what specifically would you like to go over?
I didn't get a formal outline or anything, but
I would say Josh didn't give me that much either. He just said you wanted maybe buying a business, selling, private equity, investment banking.
Yeah, I have an M&A background, so I can talk about anything with mergers and acquisitions. And I've been started a few different businesses. So, you know, good all around entrepreneur. I can talk anything around building a business, leadership, and those things. Or I could just talk about life, man. I can just, you know.
Hey, I'm at that point. I mean, business is good and all, but the general pop doesn't like that anymore kind of thing.
Yeah, so you're not Josh. You're Josh?
I'm Josh, too. That was the funny part with me and him going back and forth.
Oh, our Josh. Okay. Josh. Cool. Thanks for clarifying. Yeah. So yeah, man, I can talk. I've been doing a lot. I'm working on a bio since always, you know, thinking about like life lessons you learned and things like that. So I can talk about that stuff too.
Perfect. Yeah. I'm going to say, it's just like, one of my guests recommended, he's like, you know, you'll always be known as kind of like the business guy, but he's like, that doesn't really sell. You like ads for that are already taken up for the last 10 years. He's like, you might want to branch out. And it was a very smart business choice. He told me.
That's awesome. So how long have you been doing podcasts for?
Almost a year now.
Almost a year. Okay, cool. That's awesome. It'll get better and better. I've been doing it. I hated doing it the first couple of years. I felt like I kind of made myself do it. but then like, yeah, I'm getting, you're going from year 4 to 5, and that was just phenomenal. You'll see velocity down the road, and it's
oh fun. Yeah. I figure this is one of those right now. I just need to, it's like any business, just stick it out, make sure you don't go under, don't give in, and then just get to the point where it just takes off and you're suddenly like, oh shit, really? Like, I have so-and-so booked kind of thing. I have this much coming in.
I would just take it as a craft, you know, it's like a skill you want to get mm-hmm. better at. You know, listen to your own show. Like I did last weekend. I listened to my own podcast with my two boys all driving out to the suburbs. And you get that, and that'll help you get better. As long as you treat it that way, that it's a practice, that you're looking, listening how other people interview, trying to pick up some tips and things of that sort, and enjoy it, like have fun doing that, because you'll get good at it. And when you get good at it, then you can get so comfortable doing interviews and really have a lot of fun with it and get creative and just find your zone.
That's awesome. I want to say, I already can tell we can talk about a lot, because some guests are like, we are only talking about business. And I'm like, Okay, that's about
Talk about anything. I don't care, you know.
Perfect. I love your mic. What is it, by the way?
I'm on a Heil PR40.
Like the pretty much the sheer level, like that top tier stuff.
It depends. So I'll tell you, microphones have their own unique characteristics, and your voice has its own unique characteristics. And I highly, highly recommend trying a bunch of different mics and finding what you really, really like.
Okay.
And like record it and listen back. Like if you can get an opportunity, you could probably do it on Amazon, just order a bunch of mics.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah, record with them and then listen to it. Played back and get other people's opinions, because you have weird biases on your own voice. So get other people listen to it. Make sure you still like it too. I would do that. I would really, because this Heil is a good example where it's a unique mic that doesn't work with a lot of people. And in fact, I don't use it for long form stuff. If I had to like do more of an audiobook, I would probably get more of a neutral mic. Like right next to me, I have a Electro Voice RE320, and I would recommend that mic more generally because it's a bit more neutral, and I feel like it works well with a variety of voices. So my guess, I always put on that mic. Then I've got some other ones. I got like short SMB7, whatever, that everybody swears by, and I hate that mic. So, you know, then that's what I mean. It's like so much around the mic's characteristics and yours and how well they go together. It's almost like where you choose to live. It's your personality and the city, right? The city's got its own personality. You have your own personality. How well does that like go well together? That's kind of determines that overall happiness and success.
Right. Yeah. If you are more of an introvert and like being quiet, calm places, San Francisco or New York City would not be a good place to go to.
No, you're having anxiety all day. And
yeah. Freaking everyone screaming, even at like 4 a.m. And you're like, what the fuck's going on here?
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
So where exactly are you stationed at?
I'm in Chicago.
Ooh, Chicago. Okay. How is it over there? I'm assuming it's pretty much winter now for you guys, right?
It's getting there. It's getting cold. It's a nice city. I think I'm ready to do something different. I like it. I'll definitely be here. But it's, I don't know. I really like my preference is Manhattan. I prefer that East Coast flair with the people and just the concise directness that you get out of people and wits with it. I don't know. I like that here. It moves a little slow for me.
Not fast enough.
Yeah. Not fast enough.
That's interesting. So why? I've not been to Manhattan. What is it like over there?
Oh, it's like the center of the universe. Manhattan is one of the busiest cities. You get out there, it's condensed. There's a lot of people everywhere, a lot of walking around everywhere, good transit system that you can easily get north and south. But if you got to go east and west, you definitely got to walk a lot. I like it. I like the city. It's just got so much charm. People be like, oh, New York is dirty city because they don't have alleys like Chicago. It's a newer city, so it's got alleys. By design, they don't. So all the garbage that's up front, you got rats running around here and there. And then you smell the garbage when you walk around on this garbage day. But I'm like, that's the charm of the city. That's what makes New York, New York. Like it's like, I don't care, whatever. It's what it is. I like New York a lot. It's a good city. I personally think the pizza is better there too, to be honest.
Oh shit.
Yeah. I don't know what PR firm Chicago hired to get their pizza marketed, but I honestly, because it's just so much in the culture. Like every block has a pizza spot, if not two.
Right.
And it's just they're so all much good in the culture, and that's where I think they do a better job. A better job with a lot of the different food scenes. Chicago's doing good though. Where about you? Where are you from, Josh?
So I'm like near LA in California.
Oh, cool. You got a lot of sunshine, so you got everybody beat.
It's lately been really cloudy and cold. It's strange for California.
Oh wow. Yeah. I thought about it. I thought California might be a good option. I go there to the Bay Area for work, but I don't like the taxes, man. 13% is hard to digest.
I think they're more now too.
Even worse.
Yeah, they're taxing the shit out of everything. If they could really figure it out, they tax you for breathing too. Actually, I think they do indirectly with the gas.
Yeah, that's tough. tough one. We'll see. Florida and Texas are looking good right now.
Right? I've thought about Florida, Texas, or Nevada. But all I want to say, Florida's hurricanes. Texas is sudden freeze outs and hurricanes. Oh, and tornadoes.
Freeze out, I don't think, is like a regular thing. I think the sudden freeze out is at the minimum a once in a decade type of thing.
Okay.
Like, I wouldn't put that as many points in the decision making sort of tree there.
But yeah, then it was just Nevada, but it's just scorching hot out there. So it's like California. You better have good AC.
Yeah, it can handle the heat. Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, honestly, at this point, I like it where it's going. Can you tell me a little more about...
Yeah, I wasn't sure if we're recording and going at it, if we're just riffing and you'll just edit stuff later.
I could cut that all out later, but...
Yeah, all good. Whatever you want to do, let's just go right into it.
Then can you tell me a little about your entrepreneur journey and how your like up and coming story?
Sure. Mine's a little unique because it starts with getting kicked out of undergrad.
Interesting. Okay.
I struggled with school. I had a very short attention span. ADHD, whatever
they want to call it.
And that's probably became apparent when I was 16, but in high school, I knew I had to work a little harder. I essentially had to read the book twice. And if I read the book twice, I got A's and B's. I did good. When I came to college, they switched it up on me. They had some of these classes that were based off of lectures, and you actually had to pay attention and take notes.
Oh, shit.
If you didn't do that, you didn't have like the book to go read twice to. You had to pay attention to lectures based on lecture. And I couldn't do it. I just literally couldn't do it. I remember failing Art 101.
Really? I was just
feeling like an idiot. Like, how did I fail Art 101? So it was tough. And then I remember the first year of college, I think, was fine because I did community college first year. Then I stepped it up to university level, and that's when I started struggling. And then, you know, I even transferred schools and still same issue, distracted and all this stuff. And I don't know, I kind of didn't try after a period of time and ended up getting dismissed. They call it academic deficiency. They wrote me a letter. I basically got kicked out of school. And then that was tough. It was tough too, coming from family. It was like Indian descent. Didn't take it too lightly. They kind of like, you know, figuring out if, like, do we just kill him or do we, you know, kind of disown him? So I don't know. I remember just not even wanting to see my parents after all that. And I ended up getting a job in the south side of Chicago working for an uncle at a Subway franchise. And I think that whole cliche stereotype about working with family is all true, man. The redheaded stepchild, they just did not. I should say they weren't nice. I think they, you know, if anything, looking back to it, it's probably one of the best things. They really taught me how to work hard at the end of the day.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that's what the good is. You got to look at it. At the time, I didn't see it that way. I always felt it was getting a bit mistreated or taken advantage of, but it was a good thing. It taught me how to build good work ethic and discipline. And I did it. I didn't like it at first and wanted to get out, and it wasn't a great job market at the time, and then sucked it up, really changed my attitude, progressed, and ended up in a year managing a couple stores for them. But at the time, I decided to pursue a real estate career because I came to the conclusion if you have a career in real estate, you could be highly successful, and you don't need a college degree. And this is my avenue to create the highest amount of success without having to have a college degree. So I took the classes and took all of them. I went beyond the salesperson, got the full broker license.
Wow.
Yep. And then it came time, and I remember my uncle was offering me a partnership in a store, and I'm like, no, I want to pursue this big dream, be a real estate broker. And I went off and joined a company called Baird & Warner to sell residential real estate in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. I was terrible at it. I couldn't sell. I was still working part-time at the time. And I couldn't sell a house for the life of me. I think a lot of things. I was a young kid. I was only 21. You know, people don't want to buy houses from young kids.
Yeah.
I tried hard. I tried. I went to these things. I couldn't connect with the sale itself. It was like an emotional sale. That just, I wasn't wired that way. I didn't get it. I would make these sandwiches in the evenings at Subway. And I remember making it. I always talked to customers and I passed out my card and said, hey, by the way, if you're looking to rent or buy, give me a call. But what ended up happening, I realized I was really interested in the business side of it. And I remember this guy came in, he's wearing this Rosati's jacket. And I was like, oh, you know, the owner that owned that place owned Rosati's. And he's like, yeah, this and that. And, you know, I told him I'm looking to get into selling businesses. And he's like, hey, you can go sell this one store I got. And I was like, that could be your first listing. I was like, oh, cool. Like, let's do it. So I went, I was all excited about it. Like, I got to list this thing. And I was getting the information about it. And it was some small dumpy store in the middle of nowhere. I don't think I ever ended up actually selling it. I ended up getting hired by this little boutique M&A advisory practice to sell these kind of smaller businesses. And then they try to pick up something midsize. It was an interesting shop. It was just a couple of guys that were just getting it going. And I ended up doing pretty well there. I enjoyed looking at financials, these profit and loss statements, and presenting them, building a narrative on where the opportunity was in the business from the numbers. And that allowed me to sell a number of these convenience stores and Subway franchises. And then a year later, I said, let me go off on my own and start my own practice, which I was just turning 22. And the idea was I'm going to just sell these gas stations because they're much better than a convenience store. They have the real estate with them most of the time. And they're not like a couple hundred grand. They're, you know, a couple million.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that. I started this rented office downtown Chicago and thought, 22 years old, I'm going to get this, you know, help people buy and sell businesses as a consulting practice. And it struggled in the beginning. I remember I thought I was going to have to close and quit because I was like really running out of money. I didn't plan the whole working capital thing very well. I'm like 3 months into it. Like, I need to come do something quick. And I got so lucky. I got this deal in Indiana. It was a bankruptcy deal from some small oil distributorship, but they owned 5 gas stations. So it was like, great. And I remember the deals were really good and telling my family, like, you guys got to get on this. This is a great opportunity. This bankruptcy sale. Like, we're just literally paying half the note amount to the bank. And nobody wanted to go. They're just like, no. But I ended up selling them. They were great deals too. One of them I sold for $240,000. I kept $30,000. So I was $210,000 net to the buyer. 3 months later, sold it again to another person for $550,000. Kept $50,000. So it was $500,000 net. That was good. That guy made a good amount of money. You know, with the operating income, he made about $300,000 in 3 months. And I made about $80,000 in fees. And it really got us in the direction. I sold about 8 of those businesses the first year. And then some part the next year, I realized I hated selling gas stations. I don't know what it was. It was like too much of dealing with my own community. And it's a lot of like shrewdness. Your clients are giving you a tough time on your fees, whether they'll even pay you the fees. And I wanted to move to more of the professional realm. I really liked hotels. That's the industry I grew up around. So I ended up getting into that space. Again, starting from small little asset properties, but pushed my way up over a run. About 5-6 years, I was working with institutional properties with Kimpton Hotels, Extended Stay America, La Quinta.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's the multi-million right there.
Some of the developers in downtown Chicago. That the developers were fun because they're building these boutique hotels. And you got to be really creative on finding. You're doing more real estate. You're identifying buildings to buy with this view on how you can build it into a hotel asset. And then at some point, I got fortunate, a friend gave me a little tip about a bank that might be coming for sale. And I was really intrigued by the idea of being able to buy and sell banks and ended up meeting with the founder. And he was nice enough to give a young person an opportunity to try to sell his $100+ million bank. And I remember that deal too. It was so close. I remember we got like an offer for close to the, we got a good offer for it, but we got outbid is what basically happened by.
Oh man.
Yeah, man. It was tough. It was disappointing. It was good though. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what's given. You don't just get free right success to anything. You got to earn it and work hard for it. So that's what was an early learning, that there's a lot to learn and a lot to do. And I spent the coming years understanding that market and getting really good at it, understanding how a bank's financials work, how they operate, about the different charters, what it takes to get them, the values of them, understanding between the values of publicly traded banks, private, the acquisition strategies, who knows who, how do you put together deals in that space. And I was really getting into it, really excited about this newfound career path. And then the recession happened, started around 2006, and it just got worse and worse. And I'm here I am in 07, just downsized my practice. Had big anticipations of having a banner year that year and end up being the worst year. I just took a big loss and still practice as a sole practitioner. And I started exploring. I got interested in the tech space. I always felt that that's a promising industry. It aligned with my own personal reflections. I think when you get into the business or career of buying and selling companies, you're curious. You want to know what's the best business to own and operate.
Right.
And because you're in that field, you have this ability to do diligence on any kind of company you possibly want. Just go there, find the bank, talk to them. You don't have a buyer, make up a buyer. Just go talk, have the conversations, get the information, learn. And I started doing diligence in the early years on everything. Just animal hospitals, the funeral homes, those things you're like curious. Interesting stuff. These bunch of little ancillary healthcare clinical type of businesses. You know, like who's the company that picks up those red bags at the hospital? Somebody does, and they make quite a bit of money.
Oh, I bet. You know,
the transportation, export import business. I got as far as talking to the regional developer, the North America developer of Mercedes-Benz dealership. Their biz dev. And he's walking me through the whole steps to take to set up a Benz dealership. Like, this is the kind of property you need, how much room, acres you need, the building you got to build, the credit facilities you need to create with the bank, and just walking me through the model. And it was cool. It was a good experience to do it. It allows you to learn, and you can just keep learning, like looking at data, seeing what the trends are between margins, between industries. Realizing there's a lot, there's so many different industries out there and different types of businesses. But I concluded one thing: there is no great perfect business. They all have their shit to deal with.
Yes, they do.
And that's the thing. I ended up owning and operating a tanning salon franchise for about 15 years. And that was interesting. They worked with the franchise and doing tenant rep work for them in the early part. And they just found the business interesting. It's high margin, was minimal operations, but it still was a pain to run. I think it was a good experience running a retail business because it teaches you a lot of the fundamentals of business in general.
So I was going to say, can you tell me a little more specifically of your day-to-day for the tanning?
That was probably in the early years, a very lousy operator.
Okay.
I was trying to build this other practice, and you just sort of threw managers in there and take them out. I think it wasn't until later where the recession started, and then I actually had more time. So that business has probably been around for about 5 years, and I got to spend a little bit more time and get involved and learn more about what customer experience is, learn more about what drives growth. And get in there. And then I think maybe it was the timing of it, but for whatever reason, that business did much better during the recession. You know, the theory was people weren't going to expensive spas. They were just coming to go get a tan and massage instead. But there was a lot of just conscious effort on improvements and building in a culture of continuous improvement, even though it's a small retail team and there's students that mainly work there, but just teaching them that, hey, we're trying to be the best. You know, our goal or mission is to provide the ultimate customer experience, is what we called it. And I worked with them to define what that is. And sometimes you got to sit back and just be dumb. Like, forget what you know. Forget what you know is right, or just be like in the mindset you don't know anything, and let people speak up. And they went through and they defined what the ultimate customer experience was. And I said, okay, let's write this down. Let's put it down somewhere. And it was the things that you'd expect: just spectacularly clean, a great service, smile, greeted when I walk in the door, you know, all these little things. I said, yeah, this is what we're striving for. This is our mission, right? With the ultimate customer experience, we defined it. Now we're going to go pursue it. And that's what got the alignment between the team. That, hey, I don't care whatever you got going on outside, you know, boyfriend issues, whatever it is, I don't care. Just when you come in, game face on, and what's our mission? Pride is like, that's objective. You got to do that.
Right.
You're not doing that, then it's, and then when it comes to decisions or little things, because people get ideas or they don't agree with things, you can always reference that. You got an idea, but great. Does it align to that mission? Does it allow us to provide this ultimate customer experience? No, it doesn't. Okay. Like this. So there's, and then build a case around it, like explain why. So that way you get an idea, you can explain what the value is or how it aligns with our initiatives. And just kept that going. It just kept the culture there where everybody's thinking of different ways to improve. They get recognized for their ideas. The customers are happy. You know, it was really great when they had very happy customers write reviews online, and it became the best form of Instagram. And when they call them out by name, so it was really cool. I think the big thing I learned too, I can reflect on that even from some of these organizational psychology books I looked at, when you look to define the ideal workplace, and the key elements are having a strong communication platform where everybody in the team feels comfortable to speak up and share their ideas, as well as point out problems. Especially when you're a growing organization, problems appear quicker than you think. And somebody needs to be able to say, oh, there's cracks appearing on the ground, and we need to figure out how to fill them in. Otherwise, it grows and it blows through. That's one, is the communication. The second is to acknowledge achievements. And again, it gets challenging in a growing organization because you got different teams and they're separate. And how do you
get
the acknowledgement across teams? But that people want to be appreciated for the work that they're doing. They want the acknowledgement. And most of the time, that means more than the capital or the money you're providing them. So that's making sure that's there. It doesn't take much. It just takes a little bit conscious effort of just acknowledging it. I mean, know what it means without that person doing that. You know, that's, well, what would happen? So they're keeping things together. And that's a stop to be like, hey, I just want to acknowledge, like, you just showing up, being here is like a great thing because you're, you know, keeping things going and providing this experience. I think as well with that is making it comfortable to criticize. You know, there's this, people want to feel appreciated. It's a little bit different work when you create a company to make people feel comfortable with the criticism. And it's something that I think is extremely important, like just as much as that. And I would say it creates an ideal workplace, because if you're not there to be challenged and grow, and it depends on the ultimate company culture you're trying to create, you need to be able to take the criticism.
Oh yeah.
And I'll tell you, Josh, like, you have to tell people this. You can't just give them. Sometimes if they're not used to the criticism, or you, the way you are about it, you have to address that, give them a disclaimer. Because this natural psychology is you tend to fuse together this business line of communication and personal line together. So if I criticize you, you get this feeling that I'm insulting you, or I'm hurting you, right? I'm not, and that's not good. You know, and that's why you got to tell them, say, look, man, separate this up. Two different channels of communication. We're going to have your direct business objective, what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to give you feedback so you can get better. And if you get better, the team gets better. That benefits everybody.
Right.
Versus this personal, you know, I'm attacking you or not. No, throw that away. Like, forget about that. You know, if it's that bad, you can talk about it, but that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm giving this feedback to, so you got to tell people that sometimes. I think periodically you got to even remind your whole team that, hey, this is the culture I'm striving for, that we're good enough with each other, comfortable with each other, to give each other that feedback, to be a little constructive about ideas and share the ways we can improve. And that's good. That's good to have that. That helps foster that communication, being comfortable to find these ways to improve, challenge, get better continuously. The last but not least is creating an environment where you feel you work amongst friends.
Okay.
It's an important one. I think that's why those social outings and things like that, where you can be in just an open environment to be yourself and share stories, get to know people you work with. It's important. Important just to get to know each other, learn about your families, things of that sort. Just feel comfortable. I think we all find out that we have a lot of things in common fundamentally, and respect our differences in a lot of ways too, like cultural differences and so forth. So I know those are the three big areas when we look at what's driving. I said retail business teaches you a lot. It teaches you a lot of the basics of a business, because it does apply in a larger company in different ways, or as your company grows. I think it was interesting to see, because you went through this retail business, I had the consulting, here's a downturn that happens. Downturn, we start getting out of it. I was really interested in tech. I started exploring these little tech startups and learning so much about it. It was interesting. I started buying a bunch of .coms. I had this idea. I bought a .com, and I had something where I wanted to get traffic to the website, and blogging was the thing. So I found this funny thing that if you posted a blog, and we just write a really basic script that, instead of posting the same blog on the next visit from the same IP, it would change it to a different blog post. And I just had like 5 rotating blog posts. But somehow this like tricked the Google algorithm to think I was constantly updating.
They didn't take that well later on.
There's a big company that was spending billions in building smart, intelligent, ad model. So me versus this massive organization that's continuously optimizing the algorithm, there's no chance. But I didn't see it. I didn't have that long sight. I was very short sighted on it, because I saw the success and like threw some AdSense on there and was generating some income. And I said, well, I could buy a bunch of .coms, and I can do this times. I can scale this, and I can like turn this into a million or so a year business. So I started doing that. I started buying. I had 550 .coms at one point.
Oh shit!
I had about 200 websites powered up. I was using one of these big open source frameworks like Liferay and Alfresco, and really built some custom system and started doing this. It was interesting. Along the way, I got sued by this RBS, Royal Bank of Scotland, because I owned mintbanks.com. All these were financial keywords I was buying up, because I noticed they had the higher cost per click rate. They're like, $2-3 a click, while back then everything else was 25 cents, 50 cents.
That's interesting.
Started picking up, but then,
Just get a cease and desist. They're like, we're full on suing you.
Oh, those guys, I forgot about that. They got a law firm. They sued, and they it's funny, you go through this whole arbitration and basically you like lose the domain. They come confiscate your domain away, because I lost it. I didn't want to spend the money legally at the time, so I had some pro bono attorney work on it and ended up losing the thing. And
more than the domain.
That's what I was upset about, because they had some large like Trotman Sanders or some big law firm. And I was like, you could have paid me more than you paid these lawyers to do this, like I would have been happy with $5,000 or something, but
it was like $5,000. Just shut the fuck up and give us a domain.
Yeah. Basically just, we'll buy from you. Let's be friendly about it. You don't have to be bullies. Just like, hey, we have this trademark. Can we just buy this from you? You didn't even try buying it from me. Just went out and sued, which is, a thing of it.
That's a whole pickle in and of itself.
Exactly. That was good. It was a good experience learning that. It was not good at the time. It was a costly experience. Because we're spending a lot in custom development, building all that stuff out, and went to zero. Literally all went to zero. Even those domains, I got maybe not even 80 of them. You know, some of the good keywords that are fun ones, but got rid of all of that. And I was really interested in the industry I came from, M&A. Went through a couple different ideas, but settled on this idea of a project management tool to manage M&A. And it was really influenced by looking at what was happening in the software industry and using some of the project management tools to manage developing this custom software we're developing. And that's where we started the company Deal Room back in 2012. Went through a whole bunch of iterations to really get it right. A lot of lessons. Like I came from consulting, this, you know, the retail experience along the way. And I didn't know software development. And it's like any other business, to be successful, you got to be really good at it.
Like right.
If you're a restaurant, you have crappy food, it's not, you know, going to go that far. If you're building software and it's not good software, not going to go that far. So there's this competency, ability to develop good software. And that took a while to learn because you're dealing with engineers. You need some level of understanding of technology. And I went through it. I went through that. I think product market fit was so different because you don't realize how much assumptions you have about the user when you build software, and you need to learn how to keep short feedback cycles to be able to validate the problem. And as you go through the phases of understanding the problem to the phases of modeling or concepting a solution to understanding how do you take that solution to market and get people to actually pay for it. But that was all learned through that experience with Deal Room.
Okay.
And it took a good 3 years to really know what you're doing. Like, just cause I didn't come from that.
No, so you had to, like, since you stay up at night and just learn coding too, and you're just like, oh, so this is what they're talking about. Or did you more delegate to others and were like, hey, if something comes up, I might not know it, just explain it to me, kind of thing?
Yeah, I was fortunate. I had some money from my prior roles that I could hire developers, and I don't think coding is my thing. I tried it and was like, this is not me.
I tried
but
that too.
I would say I did learn to project manage.
That works.
I learned enough about the technology to understand the concept, how it works, and be able to at least understand the application of it so that I can ask questions around it. Which helps when you're working with engineers, because then they know that you at least got your head there. You know, you may not be there doing hands-on and shoveling dirt or anything, but you're at least there on site. If you're not able to do that, I feel like that's where a lot of these challenges come with tech teams and the business people, that they don't get that alignment. And as a business person, you need to spend the effort to be some level of tech literacy. So the more the better. Like, why not? And Wikipedia is my best friend. I spend hours looking at Wikipedia. Every time I come in an acronym, PHP, Java, I look it up and get a bunch of links to more acronyms and look all those up and just sit there and read for hours and hours and hours. So that's where I started, is this sort of project management. Here's a concept. I think you learn the hard way. I learned the hard way of getting that feedback loop, because I didn't do that. I had a lot of assumptions. I built something that wasn't right. It's not what the market wanted or needed. When I got to the point, I said, hey, let me start from the drawing board and spent the time to do these interviews with the people I was targeting as customers or their cohorts of potential customers. That's when I realized that there's a different way to look at the problem, that they were looking at it, and then started focusing in a different area that allowed me to get to where we are today, because we created that approach and made it part of our organization and continue doing it, so that we kept evolving and iterating this product to solve additional problems, where we solved the one specific area of managing the diligence in M&A, to then solving the integration management challenges, solving the pipeline management challenges, and all these little things in between. I was really fortunate when growing that business. It was probably 2017. I had a friend in marketing, Andy, and Andy he was a good person, full of ideas. Like that, that was the work with him. You know, as a friend, you go hang out with him, but then you're like, damn, I got all these ideas I got to build on. And, but the one he kept pushing the most was doing a podcast. He said, you got to do a podcast. You got to do a podcast. And I was like, I don't know. But he's like, well, you just told me you've been recording these calls with people and you do it part of your research and how you learn a lot. He's like, just share that. You know, that's all I got to do. I was like, that's not a bad idea. I brewed it for a little while and married it with this idea or understanding that in our industry, there's this big underpinning problem of the industry itself. It's very fragmented and disconnected and it lacks standardization. Like company to company, they're doing M&A so differently from each other that there's no go-to source of truth, proven model, real evidence that this is the way you do M&A. So that's where we took the idea of using a podcast as a platform to enable M&A practitioners to be able to share their lessons learned. And in turn, we look for the patterns. We identify what are the proven techniques in the industry. You know, what base that off of some actual evidence from these qualitative interviews.
So that, what are some of the baselines you saw then?
There is a lot of good lessons. The big theme is about M&A shifting from being focused in finance to being focused on people.
Okay.
Right. In the early days, you look at a business, it's all about the numbers, all about the numbers. You look through their financials, you model it out, get an idea of how much you can make in the future, and you come up with a price, you negotiate, you buy the business. Over time, what we're realizing, the ultimate determination of success is how well you execute on your post-close plans, which typically involve integration, just different activities to generate value from the business, your value creation plans. That's what matters the most. Whatever that valuation number is, doesn't really matter. That model is a promissory note, you know, and it depends how thoughtful you were. Did you include the people that were supposed to help execute the deal or the integration and value creation activities into building that model? And they have full ownership of what they're supposed to go out and do to capture that value. And it just ultimately, it's all about the people at the end of the day. To generate that value that you estimated, you have to have people aligned, working together to achieve those things, like any other big success.
Right.
That's where we see things going. It's just shifting from finance focused to people focused. And that's where you need to change the way you look at a deal and think about the people from the very beginning. Think about the organizations, what their cultures are like, what their unique values are. Get understanding of that. And then you can get a sense of how you will be able to align those people to this end state, you know, this vision of where you're going to take this company. What are you going to do to create this value? We're in this competitive market where you just can't go buy a business and it's going to generate money for you. You're going to pay a lot for a business and you better have a good, clear mind, a way, vision or idea of how you're going to create additional value synergies from the business to increase that value so it's profitable if you sell it down the road or make your next exit. To do that, you need to have that vision and you need to bring it up front early into the deal process so you can get aligned with the company that you're looking to acquire and say, hey, this is the reason, this is my rationale for buying, and get that buy-in so that the other executive team that you're going to be working with, they're aligned. They get an understanding, they believe in it, and they're aligned to help execute and create that value. Because a lot of times we've got the secret, all about the numbers, all about, and we don't even think this stuff all the way through. We bought the company and then we're like, all right, how are we going to actually do this? How are we going to go create the, you know, we haven't even created the full plan yet. No, you should be thinking about how you're going to go to market together. You know, what's that, after we've done buying you, what's the customer experience going to look like from the customer's perspective? Like, walk me through. Do we have two separate brands? Do we merge it together? Are we changing ours name to yours? Are we doing some co-brand thing? What's the story we're going to tell the customers? Are we going to explain why you even merged together? What, there's the CEO's had some vision and value behind that deal. Well, did it mean anything to the customers? You know, hopefully there's some opportunity there to create some additional value or better experience to the customer. And this team hasn't been communicated that to tell them. That's where it's all about the people. If we can align around what the goals are or we're trying to achieve, that, hey, we're doing this acquisition because our capabilities combined are going to allow us to provide more value to the customers in the market. The customers that we serve, we're going to be able to serve them better. We're going to bring these unique capabilities that we didn't have, and we're going to be able to help them with it and help them generate value and create more value, which in turn, you tend to get compensated more when you create more value for your customers.
Oh, 100%.
And then that's what we're trying to achieve. That's where it's so important to align people around what the goals, the missions are, and make sure they have the common values that they can build off their way of working together.
So one thing I've noticed talking to different executives and M&A specialists is a recent one I've noticed. I don't know if you've noticed it or not, or you've seen it, just tabbed it as something else, is the actual relationship of the employee to your client. One of the ladies I talked to a while ago, she said she actually is more interested in what that one person has in connection to your client. And if for some reason you remove that person, will that big client leave too?
The relationships with the customers is absolutely something that's part of the diligence you do in a company.
Okay.
And they'll look at that as even customer diligence, where they want to understand that, how tied they are to the organization or the specific dynamics of is it for the firm's services? Or are they there for a certain person's relationship? But then also, what are other factors that may make them vulnerable? You know, how married are they to the company? Are they just very price sensitive? Like, there's a lot of different factors to get understanding of where that customer sits to know what could be some risk factors that come in. For that example, maybe they are very dependent, that if a third of the sales team leaves, you can expect a third of the customers are going to leave.
That could be a huge problem in the future if it doesn't work out.
And that's the thing. You want to know that as a risk. And when we look at diligence and M&A deals and exercise, the exercise is based on identifying risks. We want to justify our rationale to pay the price we are for the business. And with that, we need to understand the risks. So there are a lot of risks that may not be worth doing this deal.
Right. That's interesting. Okay. So it is the same, but phrased differently. Okay. That was just a big one I picked up on. It is just that the lady said, like, the numbers are good and that it's making money, but it's like, is that one employee, like, if they just up and leave because you pissed them off, is half your customers leaving too?
That's a risk, but you want to look at the people side. Like, what is the flight risk? Who are the key people in the organization? What does that flight risk look like? And understand how happy they are. And then with that, there are strategies to develop retention plans. So you can focus on those key folks and really build some incentives and drivers to make sure that they stick with the organization.
I'm just curious, how do you calculate the flight risk of someone?
Talk to them. If you can't talk to them, there's indicators there. There's some phenomenal HR practitioners out there that know this to a science of a PhD degree, where there's ways to even pick this up. You know, there's ways to even pick up sentiments when you look through sources online, where we've got these great databases like Glassdoor and things where you can get a sense of what people are saying in there, what the culture is like, and then knowing who the key people are, talking to the key leadership people to get an understanding from them. And a lot of times they may be able to point them out, but being able to just be conscious that there may be some key people that aren't so obvious. We know we have the local mayor in the company that isn't on the management team, but you know, everybody knows and respects that person. So they're like essentially the internal influencer.
So wait, was that an actual company you dealt with? Like the local mayor was on the team?
No, I meant like there's like, you got the neighborhood mayor.
Oh, you know, okay.
You know, there's a kind of like that person that's got a lot of influence there, but they may not be an executive leadership role. They may could be in a middle management role, or, you know, you didn't really look at them. You know, you could still discover that. That's where it's still important to do a lot of diligence to uncover these different things. M&A is tough. M&A, to do M&A right is very difficult.
It sounds like it. It's one of those, you have to be at it for a long time and gone through a lot of shit like you did to finally be like, okay, I know what I want now. This is what we're doing.
It is. It takes the right piece. It takes a group understanding the skills you need. The right people, the right proactiveness. You have to be really proactive. If you're not and you're reactive doing M&A, you're going to lose a lot of value. And there's just so many challenges that come up. It's unpredictable because you'll come across things and it's a new risk that you identified. You got to figure out how to mitigate it or find some way to deal with it. And then the other one is these opportunities you'll continuously find as well. And you need to build it into your plan so you can actually act on that opportunity and generate value. And then there's all these little twists and turns that could happen. Your deal could blow up for one reason or another. There's so much effort to get the deal done. But then that's when things start. You got to really do all the work to get the value out of the company.
I'm going to say, what's the ratio for you? How many like deals blow up on you? I assume it's less now, but just in general.
And now we're in such a different spot. We just support large corporations and their M&A. So our business today, Josh, we mainly work with corporates of a billion market cap and up. Okay. And we've got some large ones like Johnson & Johnson. And then we'll do these private equity backed roll-ups, and they could vary in size because they could be really early in doing a roll-up, but they're usually a branded private equity firm that's sponsoring it. We'll do those. Those are our two bread and butter businesses. My background, I did mostly, everything was under 100 million. You know, that's kind of where I saw my glass ceiling. My frustration in the industry was anything I got 100 million enough, I just always lost it to name brand bank. So we did a lot of like $5, $20 million in most of those deals. So there's a big difference. When I worked on those deals, those I feel like they tend to blow up a lot. There's a lot of ways those smaller deals from private company owner to private company owner can go sideways. I think a lot of it's getting quality of financials. You don't have sophisticated operators that keep quality financials, and then it makes it harder for the other party to trust, or even sometimes they can't even get the financing in place because they don't have the proper information to provide to the lender. So I think there's the sophistication levels there. I think people take the capital more personal. So I found it harder. I think going upstream, it was easier. There's a greater sense of professionalism as you move up and start working with corporations. Then there's different challenges. They definitely move a lot slower in a lot of areas. But it's good. So I think it is a different, but either way, deals blow up. We've seen a lot with even our clients' projects, because you see them, we'll start supporting it and things could shift and, you know, they pause a deal, stall a deal. So there's a lot of things to keep a deal from being a smooth, easy win.
I'm going to say, from my observations from the side, from my chair here, is I would assume that too, where the bigger corporations are slower than molasses, but usually when they decide to go something, it's like a tanker in the ocean. It keeps going that direction. So it'll eventually be done. You just got to be patient compared to, like you were saying earlier, the small ones where it's like, 5 million, fuck you, and just leave kind of thing.
You know, what's fun about working with large companies, Josh, is they have more complex problems.
Right.
Like I think when you go through the entrepreneur path and you have this realization that your job is to really solve problems, and you start looking at your industry and all the different angles and all the different problems you can solve and start developing or evolving your capabilities around solving those problems, you'll grow. You'll be able to solve more problems for different use cases. And as you go through that, you'll realize bigger companies have bigger problems. And if you can solve bigger problems, you tend to get paid more for it. So that's a little bit about that journey. I see pretty common with startups where they start entering the market, and it tends to be in the bigger part or the lower part where they see a lot of opportunities and whatever, the low hanging fruit. They want to get in and sell quick, and they tend to sell for a cheap price. And then as they just start moving upstream, it's bigger firms for higher price. I think that's what we did. We started on the bottom, went to the mid, and now it's all corporate work. But yeah, just one little thought on that. You do evolve, and maybe when you're small, you don't like the big companies, but now the big companies are our friends.
Right. So when you're small, it's like, screw you, I'm in this to beat you. And now you're like, okay, please give me your money.
Yeah, well, it's solving problems. It's at the end of the day, you have a capability to solve problems and your ability to execute on that. That's what measures you, your ability to deliver value. And that's what it comes down to. So it's fun when you can, it's more about finding the opportunities to solve complex problems when you have the capability. If you don't, then, you know, you got to kind of figure out where you're best fit for. But as we go through this culture model of pushing ourselves to continuously improve, with that, we're continuously improving our capability, and we're looking and increasing the capabilities around the various different problems to solve as we identify them. Then you can also get some leverage in having a set that we can solve a lot of different problems in a specific area, or today, the whole life cycle of the M&A life cycle.
I would say, so you're still doing the software for M&A, right?
That's our core business. We have a business line called Deal Room that is our main software product, which is a lifecycle management for M&A. We have another sub product called Firm Room, which we stripped down some functionality in Deal Room into a basic self-service data room. Okay. Industries do it. The large companies will use these data rooms. They pay a lot of money for it, but we built something that's better than pretty much most of them out there for a fraction of the price. And then we have some education lines. Our podcast is shaped. We took a lot of the content we learned and transcribed from the podcast and turned it into over 350 publications, ebooks, wow, blogs, two published books. We're working on a third one right now. That's the beauty of podcasting. Like, we took it and evolved it into a digital media business where now we do events and we own and operate an online school for M&A, and we find ways to put these things together where we learn something from the education side. For instance, recently we identified a pattern with M&A teams using, particularly in the software space, using OKRs to define the value drivers of the deal they're working on to better execute an integration. This goes back to aligning people and goals. And now we're building that into our software suite as another capability for our company.
That's awesome. No, I've noticed that. I'm just at a loss of words because my head's going way too quick. The fact that your podcast now has become, would you say, just as important or just under your current software?
Well, you know, the brand of the software, our podcast, M&A Science, has really evolved into our umbrella brand.
Okay.
You know, we start nesting everything under there. And I think the narrative is better because the software product really does come later in the process. It's the practices that should come first. The software is there to help you standardize practices, but if you can develop and create the practices, that's what would matter first.
Okay. Yeah. It's build a good core foundation, and then like your software, that's more like the fancy top hanging fruit to get that later. You need a good trunk before you get up there. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely see it's a lot of industries are like that. You got to have your practice laid down, at least the fundamental way of working, and get your team aligned on the way of working together. Then you can look at software as a means to standardize that way of working together.
And then that's where they listen to the shows and read books that you've made.
In some ways, we just like learning. It's a format to take time and learn as much as we can. and take what we learned and try to help make the industry better.
That's awesome. Do you got another call you need to get to?
No, I got some time. I got this, it's an internal one. It can wait.
Oh, okay. That's what I was like hearing. I'm like, does he need to get going?
No, it's our Slack thing. I should have had it off.
It's all good. I was just threw me off. I'm like, what the heck? So this has been awesome. You were mentioning a few things earlier and we just kind of like blew right past it, was the working with family aspect and the stereotypes. Could you go into more specific details of that?
Oh boy. Working with family. It's tough. Have you ever worked with family before?
A few times. I know a few of the stereotypes on that.
I remember my dad would always put us to work. My dad would put me to work from about 11 years old. And he had a motel business in small town, Nebraska, Fremont, Nebraska. And about 11 years old, me and my brother would have to go clean rooms. My brother's a year younger. So we're about that age, 10, 11. And it would be simple stuff like take out the trash. Sooner or later, he had us do everything. You'd have to change the beds, everything, clean the bathroom, do it all. And that's, it was just interesting. That's the way it was. It's your family got work out of you. You gotta. So there was that maybe it's just part of the Indian culture. My family's from India and that's, the culture that they had. So there was that. I think it was interesting. I was interested to learn the business. Like I wanted to learn how this motel business worked, but he didn't want me to learn it. It was always like, go to school. I think with the other family, it's just they look at you as, hey, I got to get ROI on this kid, and I don't have any hesitation to kick him around because it doesn't matter. It's just like if anything, it's just nothing. There's no repercussion. Like he's not going to sue me. I know his parents. So yeah, it's not like we're not good. But so it's a little bit of that. Yeah, it's different. You get that. I don't know. The people are a little different with you and they have the means to be different with you.
I would have think so. The few times I've worked with family that happened a lot. And the actual guy I worked with was like, pretty much said, I know you can't sue me because you don't even know what to do to begin with. I'm like, oh, great. Thanks.
Yeah, it is hard. It is hard to do that. Working with family is tough. I don't even today, I'll joke and we're thinking we haven't raised any outside capital and just doing really great as a business. But when you talk about, maybe we could do like a little friends and family, no family, just friends around. Like, I don't want any family in this business and investing at all.
Oh, yeah. Even friends, it gets tricky. It's like family where they're like, I need my money. It's like, well, I can't get you your money for like 2 years. It's a little tied up right now.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, it makes it tougher. That same thing where I feel like I got more leeway on you because your family, it does more strings or whatnot. But I don't know. I think it's tough. I even have a sibling, my brother. I've tried working with him in the business and that's tough. Some people can do it. They do it well. And I think maybe that's just part of your family culture. If you can do it and do it well, that's like a really great thing. Otherwise, if not, it's not the end of the world.
It's not. And there's plenty of other people you can go contact and have work for you. I say definitely with you, you've seen that. There's plenty of opportunities out there.
Absolutely.
So I love it. I'm actually going to got three going out questions for you.
Sure.
So other than work, what have you been doing during these lockdown times?
I'm like a dictionary definition of a diseased workaholic. What else is work there, Josh?
Do you sleep?
I do sleep. I've been better at it. I do sleep. And buy a nice bed, you'll sleep more. It's good. I like cycling. Yeah, that's been the thing I've been doing. I've been keeping up with during the sort of new times. I've been cycling a lot more.
Okay.
And it's fun. And you get to go tour around and go find these little places you don't otherwise go to or maybe hard.
Yeah. Yeah, just be like, I'm going to go this direction and see what happens.
You'd explore. I think living in Chicago, it's a fun way to explore the city. And they got some nice bike paths around here, lakefront. So I've been doing that. And otherwise, I got three great children.
Oh, that right there is three full-time jobs right there.
Yeah. So I got, I got a management approach to it. I focus most of my time and energy on my daughter. And I sort of give her the responsibility to manage her two brothers. And, you know, try to encourage her to look at them as employees that need the training. Beating them up might not be the right approach, but
at least it won't translate well in the real workforce.
Try to train them. And we're working together. She used to help me, you know, co-produced or join some of my shows, and it was fun when we were in lockdown. Now she's moved on and she's got her little business making handmade jewelry.
Good for her.
Pretty popular in her class in school. Which
good
is not
for her.
I think it's yeah. So that's you know, kind of what the approach. They still sort of stay busy, and I don't know. They one of them's taken after on trying to find some ways to create value.
There we go. Hey, at least as long as you're doing your best, not much can be held over your head.
I agree.
So someone aspiring to be like you, successful businessman, family man, what are some tips, tricks, or advice you'd recommend them to start that down that path?
To be a successful, just success in general, business, family. I would say just being dumb, man. I feel like that's the thing we miss out on. Everybody wants to have a lot of things to put out or push out. Like we get caught up in our own agenda, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what am I trying to get out of this podcast interview? Josh, no, I'm not trying to sell you anything. I just want to hang out with you and, you know, hopefully have things to share with you and some of your listeners. We get into these conversations when you meet people and you're trying to make a good impression, and we get caught up in our own train of thought and agenda and what we're thinking about. And when you're dumb, or I should rather say, if you can just get into this mindset of actively listening, you can push aside those different thoughts and agendas. If you can get into that mindset where you don't know anything, that whatever you think you know, you're wrong, and really, really listen to the other person and ask questions, it makes it far more interesting. One thing you'll learn is it's never been about pushing your agenda. It's been about aligning around others and understanding what their goals and objectives are, and being able to position or align yourself around helping them achieve those initiatives and overcome those challenges.
That's too funny.
When you do that, that helps you get more successful than anything else. And it's like taking a step further, the way you connect with people. If you can even take it further into a skill of empathizing with people, where you can understand or sense how people feel and why they feel that way, that's this like real compelling ability to land well with people. When you put that effort in, people tend to drop their guards. You know, they tend to know, like, hey, this person's at least approaching me as a peer, somebody I can actually respect, versus like not be taking the time, not providing that, not spending time to get the understanding to see where this person's head at. I don't know. And then you even take these extreme areas of getting in our disagreements. Like, we have different views, but this skill of being able to listen, being able to even go as far as understanding the other person and how they feel about things, that's what's going to allow me to resolve this conflict with you. Because otherwise, we're going to argue our own views and positions till death. Well, until we get tired and walk away and then come revisit it later. But it doesn't get us anywhere. We're going to walk away with the same feelings if instead I can try to understand why you think the way you do. If I can get inside your head and be like, well, let me I know, Josh, I don't know what he's, but let me just try to understand. Let me put away my thinking here for a minute, my position. Let me get there on Josh's side and look through and understand why he thinks the way he does. And if I can truly get to that point where I do, and I can talk to you about it and say, hey, Josh, I get it. You think this, you know, whatever it is, like we're just trying to argue between painting a wall blue or red. And it's like, you think this, it should be painted red because we got, you know, the cabinets in the kitchen that are red and it'll match. And, you know, it kind of makes the place feel a little more complete. Right. And you're just like, yeah, I totally. Yes. That's what I'm thinking. I'm like, okay. Like that ability just to connect with this person, then they inherently drop their guards. And it's like, hey, well, why do you think it was a good idea to make them blue? And you're like, well, I thought we could like spackle some blue paint on the floor and really get some ocean thing going here. And you're like, whoa, that's actually a good idea. You know what I mean? That simple framing and spending the time to be less on the defense, more on the offense, but the offense to learn the other person's perspective and views, they'll inherently drop their guards and want to understand your view or be more inclined to if you share it. And they're more likely to listen to you, right? Because you may be able to take the time to listen, but then still have your unique position. You're able to explain that at a point where the person's willing to listen because you are willing to listen. So yeah. I think that's that one thing that would drive the most success in business and personally.
I've noticed that in general, and the year of doing this is, I've always joked, but I didn't realize it was an actual tactic within empathy. Is like, how would I explain it to guests before the recording? Is like, oh, you know, this is pretty much easygoing. Where it goes, I don't really give a shit. Like, I don't really care. And it's just, it's like treated like a coffee shop. And I've never realized that was the trick that you're just explaining. It's just like, I'm here, I'm no threat, I'll prove it to you kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Just listen.
That's awesome. So everyone's made it to the end. How do they reach you and be like, hey, I saw you on the show kind of thing. I just want to say hi.
LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn. It's Kison, K-I-S-O-N, Patel on LinkedIn. And then if you're interested in learning about M&A, our website, mascience.com. We got tons of free content about M&A. So I always like encouraging those that aren't familiar, may have interest in the industry, to just explore it. It's a fun industry, and I enjoy it.
Awesome. Wonderful. Thank you for your time and all your insights. I learned a lot. That's why I was stuttering. I'm like, wow, just so much content's going in my head.
I had fun, Josh. Thank you very much. And thank you for making this happen.
I appreciate you.
Well, congratulations. You made it to the end. You're an awesome person. Not many make it here. So being the awesome person that you are, can you do me one more awesome favor? Can you rate and review this on whatever podcast services you're using? App, if you do it on Apple and you leave an actual written review, I have a thing on my website. I will take your written review and post it for all to see. Congratulations, you're permanently sealed on my site. Otherwise, I am trying to do YouTube more and live streaming. I will try to put as many of the YouTube links in the description of the show as I can. So give your boy some extra help over on YouTube. Watch my videos. I just mute it and change the channel, change the window or something. But yeah, that's it. Thank you for being awesome and see you next time.